Hello and welcome to another episode of On My Last Eggs.
You know, in general, need to be eating better. And there are loads of diseases that we could prevent, you know, decrease long-term chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease, dementia, osteoporosis, cancer. And that's all by having a better diet. At the menopause, there's no better time to really focus on that because your needs do change.
I'm Rachel, and like millions of other women worldwide, I am navigating the wild throes of perimenopause. And over the next few weeks, I'll be lifting the lid on what that whole messy, confusing journey entails.
And so by changing your lifestyle and by changing your diet, you can actually bring those risks down.
I'm excited for this week's episode of On My Last Eggs because we are talking about something I love, and that is food. And we are joined by nutritionist Dr. Harriet Holm. Hi, Harriet.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's a real pleasure. I firmly believe that we don't pay enough attention to what we put in our bodies, full stop. You know, I say to people, you wouldn't expect a car to run well if you just poured milk into it or beer or whatever, and occasionally put some petrol in and said, oh, that's enough, that's fine. So I'm a big fan of, you know, paying attention to nutrition and what our bodies need. And then I think when it comes to menopause, like, crank that up times three. No pressure, but please tell us all the secrets, the holy grail of what we should be eating in menopause.
I agree with you entirely. I think, you know, in general, need to be eating better. And there are loads of diseases that we could prevent, you know, decrease long-term chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease, dementia, osteoporosis, cancer. And that's all by having a better diet. And as you say, at the menopause, there's no better time really to really focus on that because your needs do change. So with the menopause, as the hormones naturally decrease, and one of the most important ones is estradiol, it does have wide-ranging effects on a number of different functions within the body. And that declining level of hormone actually puts you at increased risk of things like osteoporosis, so that's brittle bones, so much so that like a 50-year-old would have a 2% chance of a brittle bone factor, where by the time you get to 80, that's gone up to 25%. And then there's cardiovascular disease and dementia. And so by changing your lifestyle and by changing your diet, you can actually bring those risks down. So first of all, if we talk about bone health, so ensuring that you eat good quality protein at every meal, that your calcium needs go up from 700 milligrams to 1200 milligrams a day. And I think that's really difficult for a lot of people to visualize. Certainly, I've made little crib sheets of nutrition checklists where you can understand what a portion of an average food looks like and how that translates to calcium, because otherwise it's just really challenging. You know, what on earth does 1200 milligrams of calcium look like?
What does 1200 milligrams of calcium look like? Now we're a chat and calcium.
Absolutely.
Exemplify it for me.
So calcium rich foods are things like fish where you eat the bones, so like tinned salmon, dried figs, tofu, like firm set tofu, and dairy. They're all really great sources of calcium, and some and leafy vegetables as well. But those are the main sources. Quite hard to get it from a vegan diet, really looking for those dried fruit and the tofu. So it's sort of a challenge, I think, without knowing that you need that extra calcium, you probably wouldn't just naturally eat it in your diet. You have to be aware that you need that extra calcium, and so start eating some of those things if you don't already, or eat a bit more of them. And then another nutrient that's really important is vitamin D, and that's often called the sort of sunshine vitamin, because our diets don't really contain very much vitamin D. We mainly get it from the active sunlight on our skin. And the NHS guidance is that during the autumn and winter months, we should be supplementing because of where we live, and that we're not getting that 20 minutes of sun a day. So especially for people who are a bit more vulnerable, or they don't go outside, or they're heavily covered up, that probably really extends all year round. Everybody should be taking a vitamin D supplement, and especially if you're in that at-risk category. And then another micronutrient is vitamin K, and that is found in lots of different types of food. It's formed by multiple different compounds. So you can't just eat one food and get your vitamin K needs. You need to be eating lots of them. And it's partly conversion in the gut by the friendly bacteria that helps you get vitamin K. So it's found in green vegetables, fermented food, dairy, some meat. And it's really important vitamin. So much so that evidence is strong enough in some countries like Japan to actually advise women to supplement vitamin K to reduce risk of osteoporosis. We don't have that advice in this country, but certainly, you know, there's good evidence out there that vitamin K is helpful. What we don't know is, because it's a fat-soluble vitamin and therefore isn't excreted easily, it's actually stored in the body in your fat stores, what the risks of long-term toxicity are. And I think that's one of the reasons really it's not advised in this country to supplement, but certainly you should be trying to include all of those things in your diet anyway, and they're obviously part of a naturally healthy diet.
I'm glad you mentioned gut health, because this is something I'm getting more and more interested in. And it does seem to be something that more and more people are talking about. It's, you know, it seems to be suddenly, forget our brains. That's not the most important organ in the body. It's our gut. It's what's doing all the work quietly. Another reason why we should be really careful about what we put into it. I read a really fascinating article about gut health, and it said you should eat 30 different types of fruit and vegetables and nuts and seeds each week, which I just loved, other than the five a day, because that you might just keep eating the same ones over. Mm. I'm vegan, so I eat a lot of those things anyway. But having this goal of making sure I eat 30 different ones every week, we've even got a WhatsApp group with a few friends where we're like, hey, I just had a guava, you know, to show off. Talk to me a little bit about gut health and how important that can be in menopause.
Yeah, absolutely right. Variety does appear to be really key with your microbiota. So your microbiota consists of all of those friendly bacteria, viruses, protozoa that live in your gut. And there are trillions of them. They're probably about the same number as you have normal cells in your body. It's a hugely important organ. Well, acts like an organ. We need to feed it. It feeds us. It has long-term impact on not just gut health, but autoimmune diseases. It even affects how you metabolize, so chemotherapy, other drugs. It's important with mood, mental health. And there's that two-directional gut-brain axis of how what your mood impacts what you eat impacts your microbiota, then you've got neurotransmitters, which impact your mood. So it's really intricately linked. The microbiota are also linked to high blood pressure, obesity, cholesterol, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. And I think really we're only just at the frontier of knowledge about it. And then how, for example, the menopause impacts that. You know, most cells in our body have got estradiol receptors, that's estrogen. And we know that estrogen isn't just a sex hormone, but actually estradiol has such a wide-ranging effect on metabolism, gut metabolism, energy balance, and fat distribution. And it also seems to impact the microbiota as well.
What's happening as our estrogen levels go down, and how's that affecting our energy levels, and what can we do to help combat that?
So if you think of metabolism as the production of energy from food, and then your basal metabolic rate is the energy required for your vital body function. So that's the energy that we're using. And estrogen actually impacts your BMR. So that's when some people sort of say, oh, I've put on a bit of weight, my metabolism must be slower. They are actually meaning their basal metabolic rate, not their metabolism. And so that's actually not quite the case. When you're obese, actually your basal metabolic rate is higher to try to move all your body around. So estrogen actually really plays an important role in that. It promotes energy homeostasis. So that means sort of the fine balance and keeping energy within that sort of fine limit. It also improves body fat distribution, which is why a number of women, when they go through the menopause, might feel that, you know, someone's just put a fat suit on me or something, because their estrogen is decreasing and it's changing all of these processes. Estrogen also enhances insulin sensitivity. So that's being sensitive to the effects of insulin. So when you eat something, it's broken down, it's metabolized in your body, and the sugars that can then go around in your bloodstream signal to your body to produce insulin, and the insulin drives that sugar into your tissues, into your muscle to use it, and it's also stored in the liver. And one of the problems is when you get diabetes, so type 2 diabetes, your body just has stopped responding to insulin. So one of the reasons why, as you age and your estradiol naturally decreases, your increased risk of obesity, type 2 diabetes. And also estradiol is actually linked with inflammation. So it's calming that inflammation down. And we know now that fat, so increased weight, all play a role in inflammation. It's inflammation that has such an impact on chronic disease and especially the increased risk of dementia, which is seen with the menopause. So also, which is really interesting, I think, is that the energy required for those resting functions actually changes across your menstrual cycle. So your lowest amount is, so that's your least energy expenditure, is in the period between your period and ovulation. So that's your follicular phase. And that's when your ovarian hormones are lowest. And so you can see then that it's mirrored then in the menopause, that as your hormones are lower, your BMR will decrease. And as you're using less energy, you're more likely to gain weight, coupled with increased sensitivity and also that change in body fat distribution.
So what can we do then to combat that? I'm always a bit nervous about talking about diet in menopause as a sort of weight loss thing, because of course, you know, we all know that it's much healthier to be at a normal weight range and not to be overweight or not to be obese, and that's something I think we should all be striving for our health. But equally, I think the message can get a bit confused with dieting when you're in your middle age, because you want to try and retain youth or look younger or look better. And certainly for me, you know, I'm trying to keep my weight at a healthy level for my health so that I can live for longer and so that my joints work and so that I don't get type 2 diabetes and stuff. But what can we be doing then, as that complicated relationship is happening with our metabolic rate and estrogen? How can we help ourselves nutritionally?
Yes, yeah, so absolutely. And I think you've got to take the sort of the cosmetic element out here, and that obesity has wide ranging effects. So it's actually really important for your health, not for how you look. How you look, I think, really needs to come secondary to your health. So just to sort of go back a step. So they've actually shown that with mice, obviously we're not mice, but in animal studies, if you remove the ovaries of mice, they gain weight on the same diet. And so I think you are fighting against, you know, physiological processes. But one of those ways is really going back to that framework of that healthy diet, which I've talked about already. And I should just say that people used to think that energy in equals energy out, and any leftover, you know, you just put on weight. And if there wasn't any leftover, if you'd expended more energy than you put in, then you'd lose weight. But we now think that's actually quite an outdated model, really, and that the microbiota actually plays a huge role in it. And they've shown in animal studies that if you have a mouse on a normal chow diet, just a normal diet for a mouse, and if you use feces, a fecal transplant from an obese human, and pop it into the mouse, they will gain weight. And you can reverse that with feces from a lean human. So it just goes to show the importance of the microbiota and what large, wide-ranging effects it has. And I think so much we've talked about already is about how the microbiota really does affect so many of these other key components. You know, is it vitamin K metabolism? Is it cardiovascular disease risk? And that's really fundamental to this, I think, that if you can improve your microbiota and if you can eat well, you're likely to have less effect or less pressure of the weight gain. And I think it's about really trying to not cut food groups out, but eat that variety, whether you're vegan or you're pescatarian or what your choice is, that it's healthy choices, that they're whole grains, it's lots of fruit and vegetables, it's lots of variety, it's omega-3, it's calcium, and that you're eating and enjoying food, because food isn't just nutrients, it's also for enjoyment, you know, culturally as well. But it's about variety, 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 support your microbiota, support all of that your microbiota is doing for you, and try to make those healthy choices most of the time where possible.
You know what? All this talk with Harriet about food has made me think it's time for a spoof song. And frankly, there can only be one. Hold on to your hats, kids. This is going to be an interesting ride. Food, glorious food! Tin salmon and tofu! Don't be in a mood! Dried figs are good for you! Peas, kimchi and apricots, what next is the question? Green vegetables won't give you indigestion. Food, glorious food, it might help you feel less hot. Eat your nuts and seeds, give it a try, why not? Chickpeas, legumes and beans,
burgers, fried, roasted or stewed. Use food, wonderful food, marvellous food, glorious food. You'll probably pile on the pounds, but frankly, if it helps you through the other symptoms, why not give it a go? And now, with no further ado, let's go back to Harry at home.
Obviously, you've got the things you mentioned, you know, sort of the bone health and osteoporosis and dementia and cardiovascular disease, you know, all of which postmenopausal women are, you know, at higher risk of getting. What about symptoms? Because we don't consider those as, you know, those are kind of, you know, gifts that you get as you get older. But obviously, when people are, you know, perimenopausal or postmenopausal and having the classic symptoms, what about nutrition for sort of symptom control or symptom easing?
Nutrition for symptoms as a sort of broad topic is actually quite challenging. But I think probably the best evidence is for hot flushes. And there is evidence to support that some phytoestrogen supplements might help. A phytoestrogen is a sort of plant-based equivalent estrogen. So it's like a sort of plant format of estrogen. It's very chemically similar. And so they have similar but weaker effects to the estrogen in your body. And those compounds are found in things like soy, in chickpea, in sesame, in flaxseed. So eating those may help you. But I should just sort of caveat that to say that the supplements don't work for everybody. And those are more concentrated than you'd find in food. So you have to sort of think that if the supplements only have sort of weak evidence behind them or some evidence, that food's probably going to have even less likely, but certainly they're worth trying. They're obviously the foundation of a healthy diet anyway, and are good things to be eating. Why not try them and see if they help you?
Is that, by the way, why I've never had a hot flush? Because I am all over those foods being a vegan. And it's the most unscientific study ever, a study of one person.
Maybe, or, you know, maybe that's just your genetics and your, you know, I think it's really possible to tell, to be honest.
We were going to make a breakthrough then.
So much more information is really, you know, needed. And I think it's only with the sort of advent of people talking about the menopause and you know, nutrition studies are notoriously difficult because they rely on people reporting what they've eaten. And most people can't remember what they've eaten for breakfast, let alone remember, you know, yesterday and report it accurately. So it's challenging to unpick those themes, really.
People talk a lot about caffeine and alcohol as well when it comes to hot flushes. And obviously, as a nutritionist, you tell us we should never have caffeine and alcohol because that's bad and has no nutritional value at all, I would imagine.
Caffeine has positive effects and can be, you know, certainly has got its beneficial side. So I wouldn't say no to caffeine, but certainly alcohol, I'm sorry to say, it's very unlikely to have positive effects. And there have been studies which have maybe suggested a J-shaped curve. So that's where sort of the dose of alcohol is important, that if you have too little of it, doesn't help. If you have a sort of sweet spot in the middle before you're drinking more, that it might reduce blood pressure. But there are lots of studies that have shown actually that it increases your risk of cancer, obesity, and especially breast cancer. So I think women need to be really aware that drinking is the significant factor for breast cancer. It's a significant modifiable risk factor for breast cancer.
I want you to kind of do for me a sort of a list of don't foods. This is with menopause in mind, but I'm assuming that it's probably also with just our general health in mind. As we get older, each day is a gift that we're still here and we want to stay here as many days as we can. So, you know, broadly speaking, a list of don't foods. And then what I would like is a kind of, you know, if I was going to go and stay for a weekend in your perfect nutritional getaway, what would we eat?
If I can just answer that question back to front almost. So if I can say that for cardiovascular disease, that's your other big risk factor, and dementia, that really they're very similar what you should be eating. And then I'll come to what you should avoid. So if you think of sort of the framework of a Mediterranean diet, you've got nuts, you've got extra virgin olive oil, you've got lots of fruit and vegetables, limited dairy, lean protein, and lots of whole grains. Those are all really good for cardiovascular health, along with fermented foods as well to boost your microbiota. So those are very similar to, you know, what's helping your bone health along with that added calcium. So if you can try and have those, and then the things to avoid are things that may negatively impact your gut health. So things like processed food that's high in salt and sugar, the sweeteners, which possibly impact your microbiota as well, and then sugary soft drinks. all of the sort of things that I think we know we shouldn't be eating, but they're full of temptation in the world around us, and we live in a, you know, quite a difficult environment for that. So those are the main things, really: refined carbohydrates, sugar and salt and processed food, and sweeteners. If you can stick to whole grains, fruit, vegetables, lean protein, and naturally all of those things will have fiber in them. They're going to help support your gut health, reduce your risk of disease. And then there's just one other thing I should say is red meat. So while red meat isn't going to affect menopause directly, it does increase your risk of bowel cancer. And as you age, your risk of bowel cancer goes up. And so obviously, if you're a midlife and you're enjoying each day and getting older, your risk of bowel cancer will go up. So avoiding processed meat and also red meat.
Can we talk magnesium, please? Because I see this a lot on menopause groups and stuff. People talk about magnesium. People talk about magnesium to help them sleep. And then you think, well, I'll get some magnesium. And it's not as simple as that. There seems to be like a gazillion different types of magnesium. What is magnesium doing to help us in menopause, if anything? And what kind of magnesium should you get for what kind of thing? Or is this all snake oil?
So magnesium actually has really wide-ranging effects in our body. It helps convert food into energy. It helps create new proteins from amino acids. It helps repair both DNA and RNA. It's also part of contraction and relaxation of muscles. It helps regulate neurotransmitters. And so you can see it has lots of really important roles. The problem is a lot of our diets these days have sort of tended towards foods that don't contain magnesium, or we're avoiding those good sources that do. So good sources of magnesium are things like fruits and vegetables, like bananas, dried apricots, peas, beans, seeds, legumes, soy, whole grains, nuts, which on a sort of Western diet is often just not eating them in the quantities we need to be. So which is why a number of people are deplete. And certainly people do say that magnesium may help with their insomnia. I think the evidence, to be honest, is actually quite weak. There's very little good evidence to support that. That's not to say that there isn't a relationship. I think we need to know more information. Magnesium has been shown to help prevent and benefit people with diabetes, but it's not a regularly prescribed supplement on the NHS. It's something that I think we need more information about. But in the meantime, you know, you should be eating all of those foods that contain magnesium, because they are really great for you. They've got fiber, they've got magnesium and phosphorus in them, and calcium as well. And so they're really part of a balanced diet.
And do you think we should be doing a lot more when it comes to research around nutrition and menopause?
Yes, I think that we're just beginning, to be honest. I think we don't know enough about how the menopause affects the microbiota. We know that lots of estradiol receptors in the gut, we don't know how the neurotransmitters produced from the microbiota, what their relationship is with that. And I think the fantastic work done by people like Dr. Louise Newson to actually really have a repository of data and information about symptoms, and then be able to track it, to look at women on HRT, to understand the impact of HRT on the microbiota and the microbiota on HRT and metabolism. I think we've got a lot to understand. You know, it's a really exciting time. The conversation started now, and I'm part of, you know, research that will hopefully find out a bit more about that, you know, help women support their own bodies better, improve, you know, more targeted diet. We don't understand how probiotics work, really. So I think there's lots to learn, lots to understand, but hopefully all of these things will really benefit women in the future.
Well, listen, it's been a real pleasure having you on My Last Eggs, Dr. Harriet Holm, nutritionist. Hopefully a lot of people are going to be rushing out and filling their cupboards with all the right foods now.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can follow On My Last Eggs with new episodes released every Monday from Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get yours. Thank you for listening.